Was wäre, wenn Produktstrategie nichts mit Zielen, Roadmaps oder KPIs zu tun hätte? In dieser neuen Folge spreche ich mit Radhika Dutt, der Autorin von Radical Product Thinking, darüber, warum viele Unternehmen glauben, eine Strategie zu haben und trotzdem im Kreis laufen. Wir sprechen über typische Produktkrankheiten, über Visionen, die wirklich Orientierung geben und darüber, wie Produktstrategie im Alltag zu besseren Entscheidungen führt, gerade bei physischen und industriellen Produkten. Und wenn du Produktstrategie nicht nur verstehen, sondern auch wirklich anwenden willst, dann ist diese Folge für dich. Hi und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge im Produktmanagement Impuls. Hier geht es um modernes Produktmanagement, strategisches Wissen für Produktleadership, Transformation zu mehr Marktorientierung oder kurz, wie du den nächsten Umsatzbringer kreierst. Mein Name ist Bernadette von Wittern. Ich bin Trainerin für Produktmanagement und Inhaberin der Product Lounge, der Community zur Aus- und Weiterbildung für Produktmanager und Produktmanagerinnen. Mein Co-Host in dieser Show ist Anselm Zebner. Er ist Gründer der EvoluCX GmbH, der ersten Software, die speziell für Produktmanager in der Industrie entwickelt wird und Sicherheit gegen Produktflops sowie 10-30% schnelleren Go-to-Market ermöglicht. Ja, und heute bin ich allein am Mikro, aber eben nicht allein, sondern habe einen ganz besonderen Gast, Radhika Dutt. Und heute geht es um ein Thema, das in vielen Unternehmen erstaunlich unklar ist, nämlich Produktstrategie. Und mit Radhika spreche ich darüber, warum Ziele keine Strategie sind, wie Visionen eben so formuliert werden können, dass sie wirklich Orientierung geben, wie Produktteams Strategie als gemeinsames Denk- und Entscheidungsmodell nutzen können, statt eben nur als einmaliges PowerPoint-Dokument. Und ganz besonders schauen wir eben auch explizit auf physische Produkte und industrielle Produkte und darauf, warum viele gängige Strategieansätze aus der Softwarewelt eben nicht funktionieren. Und wenn du also Produktstrategie nicht als abstraktes Konzept, sondern wirklich als konkretes Werkzeug für bessere Entscheidungen verstehen willst, dann wird diese Folge jetzt genau spannend für dich. Und wir sprechen auf Englisch, das heißt, ich switche gleich in Englisch. Radhika lebt in den USA und spricht nur ein paar wenige Worte Deutsch. Deshalb gibt es gleich den Switch auf Englisch. Und bevor wir in die Folge reinstarten, von mir noch ein persönlicher Hinweis, denn wenn du das Thema Produktstrategie für dich meistern möchtest und die nächsten Monate mit meiner Begleitung deine Produktstrategie auch entwickeln möchtest, dann schau dir doch mein Trainingsprogramm Product Management Upgrade an. Ab dem 26. März machen wir uns gemeinsam auf die Reise durch die verschiedenen Aufgaben des Produktmanagements. Du entwickelst dabei ein entsprechendes neues Mindset und gehst auch mit deiner Produktstrategie als ganz konkretes Arbeitsergebnis noch vor den Sommerferien aus dem Programm raus. Es ist nicht einfach nur eine Schulung oder eine Weiterbildung, es ist wirklich ein berufsbegleitendes Trainingsprogramm. Infos und den Link dazu findest du natürlich in den Shownotes. Wenn du Fragen zum Programm hast, dann kontaktiere mich gern. Auch hier findest du alle möglichen Wege in den Shownotes. So, und jetzt möchte ich natürlich dich nicht länger auf die Folter spannen, sondern wir starten jetzt in die Folge rein mit Radhika Dutt zum Thema Produktstrategie und ich wünsche dir ganz viel Freude beim Zuhören.
Alright, so let's start.
I'm really delighted and excited to have you here today, Radhika. Welcome to the podcast, Product Management in Purus.
Thanks so much for having me, Bernadette. We met at Just Product in Munich, and I'm excited to be here after seeing you there in October.
Yeah, and I'm actually so proud that you followed my invitation. So this is really, really a cool thing today. So I was looking forward to it, and now it's here. Today is the day.
Oh, I very much remember our conversations. I've been excited for this recording. And you know, the industries that you work in, for me, it's a very special space. Like, it's not necessarily what a lot of product management resources focus on today, but I think it's such an important aspect of our economy, and we really should be thinking about product management. So I love the work that you're doing. And so, yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So exactly, our listeners are working in the industry, yeah, and they are product managers for physical products. And so I give a short introduction who you are. So they might not know you until now, or a few of them might not know you until now. So I give a short introduction. And you have an MIT engineering background in electrical engineering, so something that is probably very familiar to the listeners, to the audience. And you also worked across a lot of industries and different company sizes and in different roles. And you are the author of the book Radical Product Thinking, and you're also consultant, keynote speakers, etc. So yeah, how did you personally end up focusing on product management and product strategy?
You know, what brought me to product management and product strategy was really this meandering path. And, you know, funny enough, like, I'll share an early experience I had in sales, because one of my early roles right out of graduating in electrical engineering was we started a company and my role was in sales in that company. And what do I know about sales after doing electrical engineering, right? And so I had a mentor and she said to me, you know, sales is not just a job function, but rather it's a life skill. You know, so whether you are interviewing for a job or, you know, whatever you're trying to convince someone to do something for you, like whatever it is, you know, sales is a life lesson. It's a life skill. And what I've learned about product management is that equally, product management is a life skill. Why do I say that? It's because, you know, whether you're parenting or you work in government, what you have on your hand is your product, because your product is your mechanism to create a change in the world that you want to bring about. So, for example, when you look at a policy, so I work with the Central Bank of Singapore, and the head of the Central Bank of Singapore was saying how, you know, after reading Radical Product Thinking, he recognizes that a policy is a product, because a policy is intended to create a change that you want in the market, right? And so when you introduce a policy, that is your product. So the user interface to that product may be a form someone has to fill out or compliance documents that they have to send in. And I find that mindset really so important, because once you think about your product in this way as a mechanism for creating change, then you can engineer that product very systematically by having a clear vision and then translating that very systematically into everyday activities. And at that point, even parenting becomes product, as I was saying, because when you're parenting, your kids are intended to create a certain change that you want to bring to the world. You know, whether you want to create kind-hearted, good people, that's the change that you want to create in the world. And so parenting becomes a product at that point. So you can apply this mindset everywhere.
Yeah, and this is already a change in perspective and a change in mindset in here in the target audience of this podcast. Yeah, where we have product managers focused on industrial products, and most of them are engineers. And this is something I find in my work almost every day, that when I'm talking to product managers, they are focused on the product and on the features and functions the product is delivering. And the shift toward the benefits, yeah, and to look from the customer or the user perspective to see, yeah, what do we want to achieve for them, is quite often an eye-opener, a big eye-opener. And this is really a huge step in product management mindset. And I really love what you say, yeah, that this is a life skill to look at this like this. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you were saying about physical products, right? Yes, I so agree with you that rather than thinking about the features, et cetera, that we're adding, we need to think about what is the problem that we are trying to solve, right? And having that clarity of vision for what is the problem we want to solve, why must we solve this problem? And then you can figure out, like, okay, how am I going to solve the product? Solve that problem, either through a particular feature or, you know, thinking about the whole product in terms of what is the problem my product is solving in the world, right? And it's the lack of this clarity that often leads to what I call product diseases. So, you know, you mentioned how I'd worked in different industries. And this is the one thing that I've seen being consistent, irrespective of the industry I worked in, whether it was telecom, you know, media and entertainment, broadcast, robotics, it didn't matter, you know, whether it was physical or digital products, I ran into what I called product diseases. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And what I found was these product diseases happen when we don't have clarity of vision, or when we might even have a vision, but that vision becomes disconnected from our everyday activities. And that's where product diseases set in. So should I give a few examples of these product diseases and you can tell me what resonates for you?
Yeah. I think I'm not doing this podcast on my own. So I have a co-host, and we recently recorded a podcast episode also about a similar topic, what mistakes or what diseases we see in product management. And result of our discussion was that probably the fundamental base of this disease or the core disease is strategic anemia. Yeah, so a lack of strategy.
Oh, I so agree with you. And one of the reasons that is the case, right, is because a lot of the resources on product management, or even resources on how do you build products, they came out of Silicon Valley thinking. And the Silicon Valley mindset goes, just throw things in the market, right? Just throw an MVP out there and then see what sticks, and then you'll keep iterating from there. And I fundamentally disagree with this thought process. This idea of just throw things in the market and then you keep iterating. And especially when you think about physical products, this idea that you throw out an MVP and you keep iterating, it really does not work, because every iteration in hardware might be super expensive as compared to software. And so, and even in terms of a minimum viable product, the key word there is viable. So we often forget that when we're building a minimum viable product, what is actually viable? And what is defined as viable truly depends on product strategy and what is it that the customer needs. There might be what is easy to build, but it may not be viable as an MVP to test out, is this enough, right? And then keep iterating from there. But yeah, going back to product diseases. here are a couple of examples of product diseases that I'll share, and maybe that I've seen more often in physical products. So here's an example of one disease in a robotics company that I worked at. So it was what I would now call hypermetrosemia. And this hypermetrosemia was, we were so focused on metrics and numbers and measure everything. Measure everything was the idea, right? Except like we were trying to measure everything. Big data was the keyword at that time. Like just, you know, we have the possibility of measuring everything. Except, you know, because we weren't thinking about what are the right metrics that we should be measuring, we ended up not measuring the right things after all. It wasn't giving us the data we actually needed to be able to make changes. Like what we needed in this robotics company was, we were trying to figure out how you reduce downtime in this robotics company. And what we needed was to really understand at a step-by-step level, the workflow and at every point, what is happening, where the bottleneck is. But we didn't think about this in this very analytical and thorough way. Oh, let's just measure everything and it doesn't get you what you actually need. Right? But that's a disease, hypermetrosemia, where you're so obsessed with metrics, but not necessarily thinking through the right metrics. And I'll give you one other example, and we can talk about other diseases because you read the book. Another very common disease that I came across was pivotitis. Pivotitis is where we're moving to we're always chasing the next shiny thing. And in a hardware company that I was working at, you know, very often pivotitis came in the form of which customer was screaming the loudest. So whichever customer was most upset with us, we were working on that customer's issues in the coming sprint. And then, you know, we'd work on whoever's screaming next. But it always meant we were jumping from one thing to the next, but we weren't necessarily really finishing any particular feature or an initiative to a point where it was creating breakthrough value for the customer.
Yeah, and both diseases are also quite good examples for a missing strategy, because if you're chasing number that are not useful, you probably have not answered the question, how do we measure success and what does success mean to us? And also with pivotitis, so if you don't know where to go, then you don't have an idea which is the right way. Yeah, so we end up that you need two things. You need a vision first, and then a strategy to define a path to make the vision real. So your book gives a lot of insights and information in a good way how to come to a good vision and also how to define a good strategy. So I really would like to deep dive a little bit into that.
Yeah, let's start maybe with a vision. And yes, you know, what I, the reason I laugh is because when I say, you know, we need a clear vision, a lot of people will say to me, yeah, well, we have a vision for our company or for our product, whatever it is, right? And so why do I talk about vision in the Radical Product Thinking book? It's because typically what I see of most vision statements, and I've made this mistake, most vision statements are very broad and fluffy. So I'll give you an example. Yeah. When I had my first startup, we were building a wireless company, and this was back in 2000. This was back when, you know, 3G was going to be the next big thing. And Deutsche Telekom had just spent billions on acquiring all these different frequencies. And we were so excited that next year is going to be the year of 3G. But it never sort of materialized until, you know, the iPhone came out, which was 7 years later, right? But in that time, our vision for that company was revolutionizing wireless. And I think back to, what did that even mean? You know, we were entirely too early to market. And imagine this, was back in 2000. And what we built was a way to interact with your device using voice as well as text. This was back in 2000. And, you know, what I describe now is like the early version of Siri. And you know, we were entirely to market, entirely too early to the market, although, you know, this was amazing technology. And it's because our vision was really fluffy, this revolutionizing wireless, you know, because we didn't know what it meant, anything felt like, you know, it was fair game if it was new and innovative. And so instead, what you need in a clear vision is a description of what is the problem you're setting out to solve? Why does that problem need to be solved? And then finally, what is the end state that you envision and how will you bring it about, right? And so starting with a blank sheet of paper, I found, is a very hard exercise because that just means you get stuck in the perfect words. And the words are not important in a vision. What is important is the answers to the key questions. So here's the radical vision statement. And I'm going to share this vision statement for a product that we had built. You know, I'm going to use this example for a wine startup only because it's so easy to pick this as an example. But I could write this for a hardware company, for policy, could be anything, right? So here's the vision for a startup that I had in 2011 and sold it in 2014. Today, when amateur wine drinkers want to find wines that they are likely to like and learn about wine along the way, they have to find attractive looking wine labels or find wines that are on sale at the store near them. This is unacceptable because it's really hard to learn about wine in this way. And you run into so many disappointments finding wines that you don't necessarily like. This is unacceptable is what I just covered. We envision a world where finding wines you like is as easy as finding movies you like on Netflix. We are bringing about this world through a recommendations algorithm that matches wines to your taste and an operational setup that delivers these wines to your door. Right? And so this is why this is such a radical vision, because in such a radical vision, I hadn't told you anything about what we were building, or, you know, I hadn't told you anything about my startup. But when you read such a vision statement, hopefully you knew exactly what we were doing and why.
Yeah, because it includes the customer segment or the market segment and the problem you want to solve. And I also like about this product vision that you're talking about the status quo and why it is unacceptable. Before I learned about your product vision statement, I used the one from Jeffrey Moore, the elevator pitch template he formulated in his book, Crossing the Chasm. And this is also like a sentence for our target customer who wants to, what's the need and what's the opportunity our product delivers this and that benefit. But it's missing the status quo and why it is unacceptable. And I think if we combine this also with jobs to be done theory and say, okay, job to be done is always there and it's always somehow fulfilled. And if the fulfillment or the way we fulfill the job today is good enough, then it's not a real problem we want to solve, or there's no real market potential to really go in spend resources, spend time and money to develop something and to invest.
I so agree. I think, and this is where, you know, so many mistakes happen, right? I'll tell you about a mistake that I had made at a company. Right? We had a product where we had written such a vision statement. And this part of the vision that says this is unacceptable because, right? What we had written there was this is the current status quo is unacceptable because, you know, the solutions that are out there today, they take a very long time to do blah, blah. And, you know, we envision a world where you can do this so much easier and it's a one-stop shop, blah, 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 right? Well, when you write such a vision statement, right, what I've realized is sometimes that answer to this is unacceptable because it has to be much, you have to ask a few so what questions. Like in this case, this is unacceptable because it takes too much time. Well, so what if it takes too much time? In that particular company, it turned out that they already had those employees anyway. They already had to pay those employees anyway, you know? And so there was no so what. Even if it took time, they're like, oh, well, I don't care as a decision maker. They're there anyway. It'll take them time. But yeah, sure. So your product, you know, if it's, when you ask this question, why is the status quo absolutely unacceptable? It is super important that you've asked these so what questions, right? And you've really gotten down to the bottom of why must you solve this problem? Because so often we are so excited about an opportunity and we think we can disrupt the market. But maybe that market is not worth disrupting right now, or you shouldn't be disrupting it, right? And I'll give you one other example. It's even dangerous to society when sometimes we disrupt a market without thinking about why must we disrupt it. I live in the U.S., and in the U.S., you know, in the 1980s, they came up with a TV model, like a news model, where news is paid for by TV, by ratings and advertising, right? So what happens? So because news and cable, et cetera, is paid for by advertising and it's not government funded, the result is that they try to catch images or they're trying to attract people to watch more. User engagement is what then drives revenues for them. And so news becomes increasingly polarizing. And you see in the US how polarized we are. We think it's just because of social media. Yes, social media has definitely exacerbated it, but it started all the way in the 80s because news was disrupted with this move to an advertising-based model. And what is super interesting is in OECD countries, research shows that when news is funded by public media, society is less polarized. We should not be disrupting without thinking about, is there a good reason to disrupt? Is the status quo unacceptable? And if so, why?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that especially in technology companies or engineering-driven companies where we have great inventors and product innovation comes from the R&D department. they come up with great ideas and you think, yeah, let's do it. But who can use it? Yeah. Or for what problem is this solving? Yeah. And this leads to the problem that we come up with products that are expensive. And also R&D is expensive to develop them. And then we find out, okay, there is no market for them. Mm. And there's no real value we want to create or we can create with them. So, and what you're describing with harmful products is even another discussion, or even a very special discussion. So I also strongly believe that product managers need to be responsible for good products. And that's also my slogan. Yeah, my slogan is create products that matter. Make it, because it's not just because you can do it, you should do it, or it's useful to do it. Yeah.
I so agree with you. And by the way, you know, I love also what you said just earlier about, you know, coming up with a super interesting technology and then saying, what's the use case for it? And, you know, if you think back to that wireless company in 2000, that was exactly the mistake that we made. You know, we built this amazing technology and then we were looking for what are the use cases. And, you know, so if you want to diagnose for our listeners, if you want to diagnose this disease in your company, this is what I call hero syndrome, where you're so focused on being big sometimes, right? Where you come up with technology and then you're trying to look for this use case, right? Like you just know this technology is going to be big. But if you're using the word use cases, most likely you have this disease. This is where, this is what we used to talk about, right? We'd build technology. Let's find these different use cases for this. The thinking really has to be from the other way around. The way I describe this is, so far we've talked about vision. Let's talk about strategy.
Yeah.
When we talk about...
Yes, that's the next.
and the strategy, right? In the strategy, the first thing about strategy is saying, who is the persona who needs our product? And what is the pain that makes them come to the product? And the way, you know, in the radical strategy, the way I suggest that people answer that question is really write it from the first person angle. So write it from an I statement. For example, let's say, you know, I am talking about this robotics product. I would describe it as today when I'm a warehouse owner, as a warehouse owner, I want to maximize the billings that are coming in and out of my warehouse. But it is hard for me to do that because blah, blah, blah. So this is the problem statement that I write up, right? So now I write about it as if I'm the warehouse owner and this is my problem statement. And writing it in this I format puts you in that person's shoes and it triggers a different way of thinking. So instead of focusing on use cases where I am the engineer and I'm thinking about where all you can use my amazing robotics, right? I'm putting myself in that warehouse owner's shoes and then I can describe what I need exactly. And as you start describing it from the warehouse owner's perspective, you're going to realize there's so much I don't understand. And that means you're going to have to go and observe these warehouse owners and like, what does their day look like? What is happening? Like, how do they think? What are their mental models? And now, finally, when you understand their mental models, you're able to write the statement from an I perspective in your strategy to say, here's what I need. This is the pain that drives me.
Yeah. Yeah, I do this with, or I teach this with the empathy map, so that you put your shoes, to put yourself in the shoes of your customer or user, and think about what do you see, what do you hear, what do you feel, what do you say, what do you think in the situation? Yeah, to really, enable that change of perspective. Yeah.
Can I add to that? Like, I love the map, right? But yet, here's one finding I've had. One, in being an engineer, but also in working with a lot of high-tech companies. My finding is that this empathy map often does not always resonate for engineers because it feels too fluffy. It feels like you're asking me all these questions. Don't get me wrong. I think these are super important ways of thinking, right? Like to start to ask, how do I feel and what's happening and what do I sense, etc. I found that it often doesn't resonate because it feels too soft and too fluffy. It's such a huge mindset shift to go all the way from this engineering mindset where I'm focused on, you know, what is the technology and what is the use case, et cetera, all the way to what is this other person feeling and thinking and what are they seeing, et cetera. And so one thing that I've tried to do in the radical strategy format. So let's talk about the radical strategy and then we can get into why it's designed this way. So the radical strategy, the easy to remember mnemonic is RDCL, radical. The R is the real pain point. That's what I just talked about in terms of who's the persona and what is the pain that makes them come to your product. Then the second question is, what is the design? And this is not the, you know, look and feel necessarily. I often talk about what is the functionality that solves this pain point.
Mm-hmm.
The third question is, the C for capabilities. So what is the engine underneath that powers this design? So to use a car example, right? The design might be that, okay, let me start with the pain point. The pain point might be when I get into a vehicle, I need it to go. I need it to get places. And I need a simple function that I can, you know, control how fast the car is going. And so the design is, okay, I have the accelerator pedal, and that accelerator pedal helps you control how fast you're going. Okay, and the capability, the C, is, you know, the engine under the hood, so that when you hit the accelerator pedal, this is the engine that powers that solution to address the pain point. And the last thing is the L for logistics, right? The L for logistics is, what is the sales channel? Am I going to sell this car directly? Is this through a dealership? How am I going to support? How am I going to train people? It has to be intuitive enough. How will I market this? How will I communicate that it exists, et cetera? So that's the L for logistics, which answers the question, how am I going to deliver this product? So again, just the mnemonic, R is the real pain points, the D for design, meaning what is the solution, the C for capabilities, and what is the engine underneath, and the L for logistics, which is how will I deliver this? And so everything that you talk about in the empathy map sort of ends up fitting into this, so that it's a concrete way to understand, why do I need all this empathy? Because unless you can truly understand the mental model and how the user thinks, you know, it's hard to build a solution that fits those mental models. Then it's hard to know what is the right engine to build underneath this gas pedal. And then, you know, because, for example, if it's not a sports car, I'm not going to put a V8 engine in this, right? And then lastly, in terms of logistics, you know, if I'm selling a family car versus a sports car, my messaging is very different. My support models are very different, right? And so your entire radical strategy is based on who's the persona and what is the pain that drives them to your product.
Yeah, yeah. So I got the point, and it's so the empathy map is just a vehicle. Yeah, of course that you step into the view of the user and the customer. So how would you define what a strategy is in general?
Yeah, so for me, where a vision describes what is the problem statement and how are you solving it, the strategy makes it a set of clear and actionable steps in terms of how are you solving this problem. And so the strategy is where you take this problem. Let's take this example of the wine startup. You know, I described what the problem statement was. The strategy is a set of actionable steps, which is where we convert that vision into, you know, who is the persona that I'm addressing, their pain points? How am I going to solve this problem for them related to finding wines they like? What do they need? What does the solution look like? Am I going to power this with AI? Maybe I don't need AI. Maybe it's just a simple algorithm that just, you know, looks even at varietals, your tastes, and suggests recommendations, etc. So the strategy is basically a set of actionable steps to translate vision into a clear plan.
Yeah, so that the team, the product management, the team who is bringing the vision into life, the product team, and also all the others, the marketing people, the sales people, etc., everyone who is contributing to success of the product can make the right decision. So for me, strategy is a tool to help make decisions towards success. Yeah. And I really like your framework because it's very clear. It's not overcomplicating things with this four steps, the four essential steps. So what is the problem? How do we solve that? So what is the design of the product? What are the capabilities we need, and how do we bring this to life? How do we yeah, what's the operational thing behind it? There are a lot of other, yeah?
Do you I love what you are saying, your point that, you know, it involves sales, marketing. I think it's such an important point because what happens in product often is, you know, we end up building a product and then that product and how we think about it focuses on engineering and design at best. And then it's like the pricing, the marketing, it's all sort of an afterthought that, oh, it's a different department that thinks about it, right? And I think one of the dangers of that is if you think about, you know, building a house or a car, you don't just build the product and then think, oh, well, you know, someone else is thinking about the marketing, the pricing, et cetera, right? And I'm not saying that in a company, our listeners are going to have the power to decide the pricing or marketing channels, et cetera, but at least thinking about the strategy in this comprehensive way, it increases the influence you have in a company, that you're able to think about this holistically. And then, you know, you have a stronger voice because you've thought about these angles and you're able to involve the right people at the right time, whether or not you have direct control over those areas.
I think for me, a product manager should have the big picture, the overall picture of the whole, the whole strategy, the whole product strategy, how we bring it to success together. And sales strategy, marketing strategy, pricing, etc. They are an important part of it. And there are some other strategy frameworks, very well known strategy frameworks, like, for example, the business model canvas from Alexander Osterwalder, or the strategy cascade from Roger Martin. And how would you say is RDCL, or the Radical Product Thinking framework, fit into this? Are they linked together? Are they complementary, or how do they work together?
Yeah, so I'll describe what was the problem statement, right? Mm-hmm. The problem statement, because I was familiar with all of these approaches to doing product strategy mm-hmm. when I wrote Radical Product Thinking. So what wasn't working? What I found with the business model canvas, for example, was it's a great way of taking all the different thoughts in your head and putting it down on paper. So you're thinking about partnerships, you're thinking about this, that, like you, at the end, you fill this canvas. But my problem with it was once you filled it out, okay, then what? So what? Like, what do you do with this afterwards? It didn't feel like it was actionable for me afterwards.
And I have the same feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so for me, you know, I've always said that a framework to me is only useful if it builds a certain mindset in people. In fact, what I want ideally is people might use the radical framework, radical product thinking framework, the vision, the strategy, the vision versus survival. We haven't even talked about prioritization. We'll get to that in a minute. But like all of these elements, right? They can use the framework, but the moment they start using it a few times, it instantly becomes a mindset. And then they don't need the piece of paper anymore. This becomes a deeper way of thinking. That's what I wanted. So everything that you see in the RDCL canvas, right, like the RDCL strategy, this way of thinking where your strategy is grounded in the real pain points as opposed to imaginary ones, right? And then how does that translate into what you build into your product very systematically? That becomes a way of thinking. And once that becomes a mindset, you no longer need, you don't necessarily need that, strategy canvas, right? Like you start to think in that way about every single feature that you're building. What is the real pain point and what does that translate into and so on?
Yeah, I have the same trouble with the business model canvas because I think it's more useful on a company level, but when it comes to product strategy, we need a little bit more tangible things. How do we derive measures and and actions from it, yeah, that are really useful.
Exactly. And, you know, since we're recording this in January at the beginning of the year, you know, the way I use the strategy canvas, the RDCL strategy, is I, for my product, I typically would write out an RDCL strategy in, let's say, January, or I do it in December or January, right? And then over time, it's a living document because, you know, I'll check in June and see, you know, how are we doing against this strategy and what are we executing on? What has felt like it's become less important? What have we learned? Right. And so I sort of do this refresh. It helps me refresh my thinking. And then come next January, I'm able to look back at the strategy and say, oh, you know, there's so much that is now different. Maybe I've learned a lot more about the personas and my strategy has evolved, or, you know, there are things that we did, things we didn't do that I want to do next year. So it becomes a living document. That's what I find useful. Whereas for me, the strategy canvas from the business model canvas, rather, it wasn't a living document. I would do it once, but then like, so what?
So, and what are your practical advices on how to work with the RDCL framework and the, how do you document it and how do you, what are your tips to moderate it, to facilitate it?
So in terms of vision and strategy, those are things that, you know, every product manager, especially the vision, like it's really worthwhile taking the time to write the vision, right? And take some time to also work through the strategy because it really shapes your way of thinking. But you do that, like, you know, every 6 months at least if you have a mature product. And if it's a startup, like an early stage startup, I would do it like every month or every quarter, just because your pace of learning is so steep. And, you know, your thinking changes, like you learn something so quickly. It's helpful to revisit at least every quarter if you're an early stage startup. And then in terms of practical tips, in terms of how do we actually use the vision? Because even if you write a vision statement, the reality is it's not useful unless you're using this vision in your everyday work. So here's how I use the vision statement, right? So your vision is useful only if it's acting like a filter. So the way you use this as a filter is you're constantly balancing the long term against the short term. And so you might as well do this very explicitly for your team. So the way you can do this is by drawing up this long-term versus short-term, this yin and yang, on a piece of paper as an X and a Y axis. So your Y axis is the long-term. Is this good for your vision or not? And the X axis is the short-term. Is this helpful for survival or not? And so when you start drawing up this X and Y axis, four quadrants emerge. Right? So the first quadrant is the easy decisions. This is where it's good for the vision and survival. Right? And if we always stay in these easy decisions, we're still being myopic. So sometimes we have to invest in the vision. This is where it's good for the long-term vision, but maybe in the short term, it's not helpful for survival. So I'll give you an example of this. This might be that maybe you're refactoring code. Maybe this is hardware that you realize that, you know, many parts are end-of-lifing soon. So you need to be able to rework a lot of the hardware in your product. You know, so this is good for the long-term vision for your products that you're redesigning so many things. But in the short term, it's not helpful for survival because it's not bringing you instant revenue. So that's investing in vision. And vision debt is the opposite of that. This is where it's great for survival, but it's not good for the long-term vision. An example of this in the hardware industry is what Boeing did. In the 737 MAX, Boeing wanted to, instead of building a new plane from scratch, they just took the same old model that they had, and they just put bigger engines on it, and it created aerodynamic instability. And the other vision debt that they added to it is to correct for this aerodynamic instability, they added the MCAS system, which is what made the planes nose point downwards to correct for this aerodynamic instability at cruising altitude, right? All of this was what created, what led to those fatal crashes for Boeing. It was a lot of vision debt. In the short term, it gave them revenues because everyone was buying 737 MAX. But in the long term, it was bad for the vision. So this is how we can think about it. And danger, by the way, is where it's bad for vision and bad for survival. You don't necessarily choose to do it, but it accidentally happens to be danger.
So this is a visualization of the different things or the different initiatives and what you activities you plan to do. And with that quadrant, with that four quadrants, you can actually do planning.
Exactly. And so once you have a clear vision, you can think about whether it's initiatives or features at different levels of the organization. You can use vision versus survival to think about what you're going to work on next. I use it even for sprint planning with my team or planning out my roadmap. You know, what are some things we're doing in investing in the vision, some things in easy decisions. You know, if I want to push back, my sales team and say, look, what you're asking for, this custom feature, it's vision debt. You know, I might show that on a 2x2 of vision versus survival. It helps create alignment in the organization so that you're bringing your vision into your everyday activities, so that your vision is always connected to what you're doing.
So we talked about the vision, the strategy framework, and how we can plan and prioritize the activities. The next thing, which is still missing, is then how do we measure success? how do we find out that we're going into the right direction? How do we measure this? And I know I also read in your book, and I know because from our conversation we had during the Just Product that you have an issue with goals.
I do indeed. I have an issue with goals and targets. But you know what? In terms of this big question of how do you measure success, I think it's actually going to be best to leave our listeners with a teaser that maybe we should do a whole podcast on just this topic of how do you measure success? Because I think this is such a big topic that I've learned so much about, you know, in my career, and why goals and targets don't work as a way of measuring success. Like when you set, you know, a target like we're successful if our product is X percent faster or X percent more usage or whatever. Like, why is that not a good approach? And what actually works instead? So maybe we leave that as a teaser for our listeners. And let's do a whole episode on what is actually wrong with targets and what actually works instead. How can we be more effective in measuring success?
Yeah, you're probably right. I just look on the watch and see, oh wow, we're running out of time. I didn't have this in my view. That we're already so late. But yeah, with the maybe one sentence for our listeners, what is wrong with goals and targets? Because I have also the issue, or I can see that with many of my clients, that they have a profit target or a revenue target, and that's the direction for the product managers, and they really struggle to derive a strategy from that. And I think this is part of the problem.
Yeah, I so agree with you. I think so. What happens when we set a target is leaders set a target and it creates an incentive for the whole organization to show, ta-da, look, we've hit those numbers. Everyone wants to show that they're successful, that things are going well. This is not even malicious. Even when people are not gaming numbers, the incentive you create is to look at the positive numbers and to show, ta-da, everything is going well. Whereas what you really want is for everyone to also not just look at the bad numbers, but to also look at the, to not just look at the good numbers and say, ta-da, it's all working, but to also look at the bad numbers and to say, what's going on here? What's the problem? Is this an opportunity? You want them to look at the bad numbers. And that's what doesn't happen when you set targets. In fact, the legendary CEO of Intel, he used to say, leaders are the last to know. Leaders are the last to know exactly because of this, because the incentive is for everyone to show you what they think you want to know. You have to invite the good and the bad message, right? And to do that, targets are not effective. And so how do you invite the good and the bad while keeping control and, you know, just motivating your team to achieve results? And this is the other teaser. Goals and targets actually are terrible motivators. They do not work well for motivating. And I will share where it does work for motivation and where it does not. But yeah, there's a lot to cover there.
So we agree that we will meet again.
Definitely. This has been so much fun and such a pleasure, Bernadette. And I'm excited about our listeners and the industries that they work on, because this is not the kind of stuff that is always targeted at, you know, physical products. So I like being able to talk about these details.
Yeah. 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 So we continue our conversation about this and talking about targets. And you know what? When I read your book about the RDCL strategy, I was the whole time I was thinking, this is the perfect, it could be done perfectly with LEGO Serious Play, because LEGO Serious Play as a facilitation method is bringing all the different views together to host the LEGO Serious Play workshop. And when I was thinking about it, and a request for such a workshop, for a strategy workshop, just came in. So I will do this. And until next time, we can talk about this as well. So we have
Third
podcast topic that we can exchange experiences and ideas on how to work on this. So
I can't wait.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your time. It was really, really great talking to you. And I'm already looking forward to continue with you on that.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Thank you, Radhika. So, die Folge war jetzt etwas länger und ich hätte ehrlich noch so viele Themen und Fragen gehabt, die ich mit Radhika besprechen möchte. Naja, du hast es ja gehört, wir machen eine Fortsetzung. Ich werde auf jeden Fall da dranbleiben. Ich hoffe, dir hat die Folge gefallen. Schreib mir gerne, welches Learning du für dich mitnimmst. Und wenn du magst, dann hören wir uns in 2 Wochen wieder. Bis dann!